I want you to imagine the most frustrating, petty disagreement you have ever had with a homeowners association.
Oh, I mean, we all know that exact flavor of headache, right?
Exactly. Like maybe you received this sharply worded letter printed on heavy cardstock because your trash cans were left on the curb for, I don't know, 2 extra hours after pickup.
Or you get into a massive debate over whether the exact shade of beige you painted your front door is technically desert sand or the forbidden Tuscan sunset.
Right, yeah, we have all experienced this. Or, you know, we at least know someone who has spent a random Tuesday evening sitting on a cheap folding chair in a community clubhouse just arguing about landscaping bylaws.
It's basically a fundamental part of the modern suburban experience at this point.
It really is. But today, we are going to look at a dispute that just completely shatters that mold. I want you to imagine that standard neighborhood disagreement
Escalating.
escalating so wildly, so out of control, that it bypasses the clubhouse entirely.
Oh, it goes way beyond the clubhouse.
Yeah, we are talking about an escalation that triggers a hyper-calculated midnight legal ambush. It drags the state attorney general's office right into the crossfire, and it culminates in an administrative judge allegedly going totally rogue in a hearing room.
It really is the ultimate manifestation of the suburban butterfly effect. I mean, a disagreement over a community election, which is a very standard procedural event, it flaps its wings, and within 18 months, we are staring at a high-stakes legal
A
hurricane.
total hurricane.
Yeah, involving multiple branches of government, allegations of jurisdictional overreach, and honestly, some of the most fascinating procedural maneuvering I have ever seen.
So today we are tracing a paper trail that is frankly mind-boggling. We have a huge stack of legal filings from the Superior Court of Maricopa County, Arizona, and these date from late 2025.
And these are incredibly contentious documents, right?
Unbelievably contentious. We're diving into special action complaints, emergency motions, detailed legal responses, and honestly, my favorite part, the raw, unfiltered, passive-aggressive email chains between the opposing lawyers.
Those emails are just pure gold.
They really are. And the goal for our deep dive today is to unpack how a seemingly straightforward request to just view some HOA election records morphed into this bitter, multi-tiered fight.
A fight over legislative effective dates, the absolute limits of judicial authority, and the exact down-to-the-letter dictionary definition of the word motion.
Right, which sounds incredibly technical, but it is so wild.
It serves as a brilliant masterclass in how the legal system actually functions on a microscopic level. You know, we often romanticize the law.
Yeah, like it's this grand pursuit of justice.
Exactly. We think of it as this philosophical pursuit of absolute truth. But these sources pull the curtain back to reveal that on the ground, litigation is frequently a hyper-technical game of chess.
It's all about leverage.
Right, it is about leverage. It is about exploiting procedural margins and understanding the exact mechanical limits of the rules governing a specific courtroom.
So, to understand how we arrive at midnight ambushes and these dramatic courtroom walkouts, we have to start at the foundation of the conflict. The inciting incident happens in February 2024.
Right, back to the beginning.
Yeah, the Sunland Springs Village HOA holds a community election. And it is important to establish the scale here. This is not some tiny cul-de-sac with 10 houses. Sunland Springs Village is a massive, highly organized community.
I mean, during this specific election, over 1,400 homeowners cast their votes electronically.
Which is a huge logistical undertaking.
It is. Managing an election of that size requires robust systems. So the HOA utilized a digital voting portal, which, you know, has really become the industry standard for these large communities.
Yeah, because nobody wants to count 1,400 slips of paper.
Exactly. Homeowners log in, they authenticate their identity, select their preferred candidates for the board, and submit their digital ballots. It is designed to be efficient and theoretically much easier to audit than a cardboard box full of paper slips.
But the efficiency of that digital system is exactly what sparks the entire war here. Following the election, the AZNH Revocable Trust, which is represented by two trustees, John and Susan Sullivan, they file a formal complaint.
And they don't just complain to the HOA board, do they?
No, they don't. They escalate the matter immediately to the Arizona Department of Real Estate, the ADRE. Their core allegation is that the HOA failed to retain the electronic ballots for inspection.
Which is a bold claim.
Yeah, they point to the Arizona Planned Communities Act, specifically ARS Section 3318.12. Now, that statute essentially guarantees members of an association the right to access and inspect community records, which includes ballots.
So the trust argues that by failing to provide the actual electronic ballots, the HOA is in strict violation of state law.
Right. But the central conflict revolves around the definition of a record in the modern era. When the trust demanded to see the ballots, the HOA did not simply ignore them, right?
No, they didn't. The HOA's defense, which is outlined clearly in their filings, is that they produced a complete, comprehensive accounting of the digital election.
They generated a very detailed report.
Yeah, a report that included a unique identifier for every single homeowner who voted. This accounting contained enough corresponding data to corroborate that each specific vote was cast by a verified homeowner, and it clearly tallied the individual votes assigned to each candidate.
So from the HOA's perspective, they are handing over the database. They are providing the exact architecture of the election results.
Right. They feel like they complied fully.
But the trust looks at this incredibly detailed spreadsheet and effectively says, no, this is insufficient. These are not ballots.
Which is where it gets highly technical.
Yeah. The legal filings show the trust was demanding something much more granular. They essentially wanted the equivalent of a visual screenshot from every single homeowner's personal device before they clicked the submit button.
Wait, really? A literal screenshot?
Basically, yeah. The trust argued that without that specific visual representation, like the digital equivalent of a marked piece of paper, the true original ballot had not been produced for inspection.
I mean, this introduces a fascinating philosophical friction between practical community management and the demand for literal statutory compliance.
It really does.
The trust is arguing that a compiled line of data in an administrator's spreadsheet is just a derivative report. It is not the ballot itself. A ballot, in their view, is the user-facing interface where the intent of the voter is originally captured.
So they are saying if you cannot produce the user's view, you cannot prove the integrity of the data translation.
Exactly. But practically speaking, that feels like an impossible standard, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, when I log into a secure portal to vote for a local initiative, or even when I submit a tax form online,
yeah,
I am not taking a screenshot of my monitor to prove the document exists.
Right. The secure database entry is the document.
Exactly. The trust's demand is like asking for a video recording of a student holding a number two pencil directly over a Scantron bubble just to prove they actually took the test. It completely ignores how back-end databases capture and store information.
Yeah, software does not save a JPEG of your screen. It saves a string of code tied to your unique user ID.
And that technological reality is exactly what the administrative courts have to wrestle with here. The law was originally written with tangible objects in mind.
Right. It envisions a physical environment, like a locked closet in the clubhouse where a cardboard box full of folded paper ballots is stored. You can open the box, pick up a piece of paper, and look at the ink.
But applying a statute written for paper and ink to a cloud-based SQL database requires some serious judicial interpretation.
The court has to decide what the digital equivalent of that physical piece of paper actually is.
So this philosophical debate over the nature of a digital record goes before an administrative law judge, Kay Abramson.
And for context here, an administrative hearing is very different from a standard civil trial.
Yeah, how does that work exactly?
Well, instead of a superior court judge handling a million different types of cases, an administrative law judge, or ALJ, typically operates within a specific state agency. So in this case, the Department of Real Estate. And they deal specifically with regulatory and statutory disputes within that domain.
Got it. So Judge Abramson presides over an evidentiary hearing, listens to the arguments about databases versus screenshots, and she ultimately rules in favor of the HOA.
She determines that the detailed accounting with the unique voter identifiers successfully satisfies the legal requirement of producing the records.
So the initial ruling validates the HOA's practical approach to digital data management. But, as we know, in the legal system, an initial ruling is rarely the final word.
Not if the losing party has the resources and the will to keep fighting.
And the trust definitely has both. Utilizing their right to appeal, they take the matter out of the administrative agency entirely and bring it up to the Superior Court of Maricopa County.
Which is a crucial pivot. They are moving from an agency tribunal into the general jurisdiction court system.
And when they file this appeal, the trust does not just argue that Judge Abramson misinterpreted the law. They claim they have discovered entirely new evidence.
Now, the sources we have do not outline the exact nature of this new evidence, right?
No, they don't give us the specifics, but we know it was substantial enough to catch the attention of the Superior Court judge reviewing the appeal. Judge Mikidish.
And Judge Mikidish doesn't just look at this new evidence, hold his own trial, and declare a winner, because procedural rules dictate a specific workflow.
Right, because the new evidence was never presented to the original administrative judge. Judge Mikidish issues an order in April 2025 remanding the case.
He officially sends it back down to the Arizona Department of Real Estate.
Yeah, with explicit instructions to hold a brand new evidentiary hearing so this new evidence can be properly introduced, challenged, and evaluated.
So the remand is basically a reset button, but it is a reset button pressed under tremendous tension. We really have to look at the broader context of what is happening here.
What do you mean?
Well, why would a revocable trust, which inherently involves legal representation and associated costs, go to such incredible lengths over the formatting of HOA election records?
That is the big question.
We are talking about administrative hearings, superior court appeals, thousands of dollars in attorney's fees, and months of litigation, all centered on whether a database export is a valid ballot.
That points directly to the psychology of community disputes.
Yeah.
When you see parties willing to hemorrhage money and time over the metadata of an election, you are almost always looking at a proxy war.
A proxy war. I like that.
Yeah. The debate over the electronic ballot is just the chosen battlefield. The actual war is likely rooted in much deeper, more personal issues of control, transparency, neighborhood factions, and probably deep-seated personality conflicts between the board and the homeowners.
It ceases to be about the legal question itself and transforms into a war of attrition.
Exactly. The goal isn't just to see the ballots anymore. The goal is to force the opposing side to capitulate, to prove they are hiding something, or just to bleed them out procedurally.
And that psychological assessment is vital for understanding the subsequent events. When you have two parties locked in a proxy war like this, neither side is going to offer grace or professional courtesy.
No way.
Every single procedural rule becomes a weapon. Every deadline becomes a tripwire. And that simmering, unrelenting frustration creates the exact environment necessary for the extraordinary legal maneuver that occurs a few months later.
Which brings us to the most cinematic part of this entire saga, the midnight maneuver.
Oh, this is where it gets crazy.
It really does. So the Superior Court has ordered a new hearing. The ADRE originally schedules this rehearing for July 24, 2025. However, as is incredibly common in civil litigation, scheduling conflicts arise.
Yeah, things get delayed all the time.
Right. The HOA requests a continuance. They argue that members of their board need to attend this crucial hearing, but they have prior commitments in July. The request is granted, and the new evidentiary hearing is officially pushed back and set for September 26, 2025 at exactly 9 a.m.
And crucially, the judge assigned to preside over this rehearing is the exact same administrative law judge from the first round, ALJ K. Abramson.
Which has to be a devastating psychological blow to the trust.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, you fought for over a year, you successfully appealed to the Superior Court, you got your case remanded to introduce new evidence, and you walk back into the administrative building only to find the very same judge who already ruled against your core philosophy sitting right there at the bench.
And under standard conditions, you are stuck. You cannot simply demand a new judge because you dislike the current one or because they ruled against you in the past.
Right. That's not how it works.
To force a recusal, you have to prove actual demonstrable bias or a conflict of interest, which is an incredibly high legal hurdle to clear.
And that is the reality of the administrative system. Judicial economy dictates that the judge, who is already familiar with the complex factual background of a case, is the most efficient person to handle the remand.
So the board is set. Both sides are preparing for a 9 a.m. showdown on September 26th before Judge Abramson.
But then the legal landscape experiences a seismic shift, and it happens literally in the dark. As the calendar rolls over from September 25th to September 26th at the exact stroke of midnight, a piece of legislation passed months earlier by the Arizona State Legislature officially becomes active law.
And this is ARS Section 41-10-92.07A. It is a new, revised version of the law governing administrative hearings, and it introduces a massive new variable into the equation.
The revised statute contains a relatively short but immensely powerful provision. It explicitly states that a party to a contested case or an appealable agency action is now entitled to one peremptory change of administrative law judge.
A peremptory change.
Yeah. Explain what that means in this context.
Well, in the broader context of the legal system, a peremptory challenge, whether it is used to strike a potential juror or, in this case, to strike a judge, is essentially a get-out-of-jail-free card.
A free pass.
It is an absolute right to remove someone from your case without having to provide a single justification. You do not have to prove the judge is biased. You do not have to present an argument. You simply invoke the right, play the card, and the judge is immediately removed from the proceedings.
It is designed to act as a safety valve, ensuring litigants feel the process is inherently fair.
But until the exact moment the clock struck midnight on September 26th, this specific right literally did not exist for this type of administrative agency hearing.
The legislative mechanics here are just fascinating. Laws do not slowly fade into existence. There is no gradient, right?
Right, no gradient at all. The legislature passes a bill, the governor signs it, and the law specifies an effective date. In Arizona, unless there is an emergency clause, laws typically take effect 90 days after the legislative session adjourns.
So for months, this new peremptory right was essentially a ghost. It was written down, signed, but legally powerless.
Exactly. At 11:59 p.m. on September 25th, Judge Abramson's authority over the case was absolute. 60 seconds later, at 12 a.m., she became entirely vulnerable to unilateral removal.
And the trust does not wait for the sun to come up to exercise this newfound power.
Yeah.
At exactly 12:13 a.m. on September 26th, just 13 minutes after the law winks into existence, and less than 9 hours before the hearing is scheduled to begin, Susan Sullivan logs into the Office of Administrative Hearings electronic portal.
13 minutes past midnight.
13 minutes. She officially files a peremptory change of administrative law judge, specifically targeting Judge Abramson.
And accompanying this strike is a secondary filing from her lawyer requesting that the hearing be pushed all the way back to December.
Yeah, and the justification for this massive delay. The Sullivans have a pre-planned, non-refundable international vacation that begins the very next day.
I mean, the timing is not a coincidence. It is a meticulously calculated strategy. They used the precise moment of legislative transition to their absolute advantage.
They knew exactly what they were doing.
They knew they could not strike the judge on September 25th because the law did not legally exist yet. They knew the hearing was on the morning of September 26th. They found the narrowest possible window of opportunity and executed their maneuver flawlessly.
It is breathtaking in its audacity.
Hey.
I compare it to playing a +4 reverse card in a game of Uno at the exact millisecond the clock strikes midnight on your birthday, looking around the table and declaring, aha, a new set of house rules now applies, and you all have to draw 4 cards.
That is a perfect analogy. It is hyper-technical opportunism. And when the HOA's legal team wakes up, checks their email, and sees this 12:13 a.m. filing, their reaction is just explosive.
Oh, I can only imagine. The HOA's legal filings are literally dripping with outrage. They immediately frame the trust's actions as blatant textbook judge shopping.
They accuse the trust of waiting surreptitiously in the wings to spring a trap.
Yeah, the HOA's narrative is straightforward. They're saying the trust has known for a year that Judge Abramson does not agree with their interpretation of a digital ballot. They knew this law was coming. Instead of acting in good faith, they hid in the bushes until the exact minute the new law activated to sabotage the hearing and force a new judge onto the case.
It is easy to understand the HOA's moral outrage here. But in a courtroom, moral outrage is completely useless without a procedural backbone.
Very true.
So, the HOA's lawyers counterattack using the Arizona Rules of Civil Procedure. They specifically deploy Rule 42.1, which governs logistics of when and how a party can actually strike a judge.
Because they're arguing that a statutory right does not exist in a vacuum.
Right.
It is still bound by the mechanical clocks of the judicial system.
Exactly. And Rule 42.1 is essentially a series of expiration dates. It dictates that your right to strike a judge expires 90 days after you first appear in the case.
Okay, so that's one deadline.
Right. And the HOA points out that the trust filed their initial petition over 18 months ago. Furthermore, the rule explicitly states that the right to strike is forfeit once a judge rules on any contested issue in the case.
And Judge Abramson had already conducted a massive evidentiary hearing and issued a foundational ruling a year prior.
Correct. Finally, the rule contains a safeguard against last-minute chaos. A notice of change of judge is deemed ineffective if it is filed within 3 days of a scheduled proceeding.
So the HOA is layering their defenses here. They are saying to the trust, you blew the 90-day deadline, you blew the prior ruling deadline, and you definitely blew the 3-day deadline by filing this less than 9 hours before we're supposed to be in the room.
And to reinforce their position, they also point to the Office of Administrative Hearings' own internal rules. Those rules dictate that any motion must be filed at least 15 days before a scheduled hearing.
Wow, so the trust missed that deadline by roughly 14 days and 15 hours.
Yes, which creates this incredibly complex legal paradox regarding how a system handles transitions.
What do you mean?
Well, how can a litigant possibly meet a 15-day notice deadline or a 3-day buffer rule for a law that literally did not exist 15 days ago? The trust's right to strike the judge was not legally active until midnight. How do you apply retroactive procedural deadlines to a newly birthed substantive right?
That is wild. The HOA's counterargument to that paradox is rooted in the concept of constructive notice, right? Legislative changes are not secret. Bills are debated publicly, they are signed publicly, and their effective dates are published months in advance.
Right. Everyone knew this was coming.
So the HOA argues that the trust's legal team was fully aware this law was going active on September 26th. The ethical standard practice would have been to file a notice 15 days prior, stating, "We acknowledge the hearing is scheduled for the 26th. However, on that exact day, a new statute will take effect granting us a peremptory strike. We intend to exercise that right immediately upon its activation. Therefore, to avoid wasting the court's time, we request a continuance and reassign it now."
But the trust chose the ambush route. And while the ambush may be legally permissible depending on how you interpret the interaction between the new statute and the old procedural rules, it carries a massive risk.
A huge risk.
Administrative law judges have tremendous discretion over their dockets, and they generally despise being blindsided, especially when it disrupts an entire day's schedule.
Yeah, the legal system operates on predictability. When you introduce chaos at 12:13 a.m., you are gambling that the judge will interpret the law strictly in your favor rather than looking for a procedural technicality to maintain order.
Which brings us to the morning of the showdown. The sun comes up. It is September 26, 9 a.m. The opposing legal teams arrive at the Office of Administrative Hearings in downtown Phoenix.
But the proceedings do not unfold in a standard courtroom setting, do they?
No, they don't. The parties are not ushered into a formal hearing room with a court reporter and microphones. Instead, Judge Abramson calls the attorneys into a room for an off-the-record discussion.
Which is a big deal. An off-the-record huddle is a critical tool for a judge facing a procedural mess. It means there is no audio recording, no transcript being generated.
It allows the judge to speak bluntly to the lawyers, to hash out logistical issues, and to attempt to find a pragmatic solution without every single word becoming part of the permanent appellate record.
It's basically the judicial equivalent of stepping into the hallway to negotiate a ceasefire.
Yeah, and inside this room, the tension must have been suffocating. Judge Abramson informs the attorneys that she has reviewed the 12:13 a.m. filing. She also reveals that she's consulted with her supervisor, Tammy Eigenheer, the interim director of the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Right, so they brought the boss in on this.
Exactly. And together, they have analyzed the situation and made a determination. They inform the trust that they are treating the midnight filing as an untimely motion.
Okay, stop there. But classifying it as an untimely motion, the judge and the director are specifically invoking the OAH rule requiring 15 days notice.
Yes. They are signaling that the procedural clock supersedes the new legislative right in this specific instance. Because it was filed late, the judge retains her authority over the case.
However, Judge Abramson recognizes the volatility of the situation and attempts to offer a compromise. She tells the room, "I am not recusing myself. I am remaining the assigned judge on this matter. However, acknowledging your filing and your impending vacation, I am willing to grant a continuance. We will delay this evidentiary hearing until December."
It is a classic judicial attempt at de-escalation. The judge asserts her authority by denying the strike, but she offers a practical concession by granting the delay, allowing the Sullivans to take their international trip without defaulting on their case.
But John Sullivan, the attorney representing the trust, absolutely rejects the compromise.
He just flat out refuses.
He does. And his refusal is not based on the timeline. It is based entirely on the foundational legal definition of a single word. He argues that his 12:13 a.m. filing was not a motion.
This is where we see litigation hinge on pure semantics. In the legal dictionary, a motion is a formal request made to a judge for an order or a ruling. It inherently implies discretion.
Right. When you file a motion to admit evidence, or a motion to delay a trial, You are asking the judge to evaluate your argument and make a decision.
Because motions require judicial time and consideration, they are governed by notice periods, like the 15-day rule.
So if it is not a motion, what does Sullivan say it is? He argues that his filing was a legislative fiat. Let's dissect that. A fiat, deriving from Latin, essentially means let it be done. It is an absolute decree, a command.
Sullivan's argument here is actually brilliant in its rigidity. He asserts that the new statute clearly states a party is entitled to a peremptory change. The legislature did not write that a party may request a change. It is an absolute unconditional right.
Therefore, when the trust filed that document at 12:13 a.m., they were not asking Judge Abramson for permission to remove her.
Right. They were not requesting a ruling. They were simply notifying the court of a legally established fact. The judge was structurally removed from the case by operation of law the exact moment the document was submitted.
Because there is no judicial discretion involved, there is no ruling to be made. Thus, it is a fiat, not a motion. And the 15-day procedural deadline for motions is entirely irrelevant.
It is an incredibly aggressive legal posture. I mean, Sullivan is standing in an off-the-record room looking directly at the administrative judge and effectively saying, I reject your compromise because you do not have the power to offer it.
The Arizona State Legislature fired you from this case 9 hours ago. You possess zero jurisdiction, and any action you take is legally void.
And when you challenge a judge's foundational authority to their face like that, the human element inevitably overrides the sterile legal arguments. The filings provide two radically different narratives of what happens next.
Yeah, the Trust's subsequent lawsuits describe Judge Abramson as obstinate, claiming she simply refused to comply with clear statutory law and illegally ignored her own lack of jurisdiction.
But the HOA's filings paint a picture of a lawyer losing his grip on professional decorum. Chad Gallacher, the HOA's attorney, writes that Sullivan was extremely rude, disrespectful, and condescending.
According to the HOA, Sullivan refused to engage in any dialogue, refused to let the judge explain her procedural concerns regarding the timeline, and ultimately stormed out of the room.
He physically departs the Office of Administrative Hearings. He abandons the off-the-record negotiation and leaves the building before any formal hearing can even commence.
This presents Judge Abramson with a huge crisis. The opposing counsel has literally walked out of her courtroom based on a jurisdictional disagreement. She is left sitting in the room with only the HOA's lawyer.
And she doesn't just pack up her briefcase and call it a day, does she?
No, she doesn't. She initiates a critical mechanical shift in the proceedings.
Yes.
She goes on the record.
Going on the record is a deliberate, formal action. She turns on the audio recording equipment. She states for the official transcript that the matter was scheduled for 9 a.m., that the parties arrived, but that the representative for the trust has voluntarily left the premises.
And the HOA's attorney, seizing the moment, formally requests that the case be dismissed due to the petitioner's absence.
And Judge Abramson grants it. She issues a formal binding order stating, petitioner's case is dismissed based on the failure to proceed with the matter.
Wow. With a single sentence, she throws the entire 18-month proxy war out the window. The trust loses not just the battle over the judge, but the entire case regarding the election ballots.
It is the absolute nuclear option. But the trust immediately goes on the offensive, arguing that Judge Abramson's nuclear option was actually an illegal detonation.
Right. They dissect her dismissal order using the Arizona Administrative Code, specifically zeroing in on AAC R2-19-117.
And this rule is the fulcrum of the trust's retaliation. R2-19-117 explicitly governs the exact scenario that just played out. What an administrative law judge is permitted to do when a party fails to appear for a scheduled hearing.
And the text of the rule is incredibly precise. It states, if a party fails to appear at a hearing, the administrative law judge may proceed with the presentation of the evidence of the appearing party or vacate the hearing and return the matter to the agency for any further action.
Did you notice what's missing there?
Yeah, the trust's legal team reads that rule verbatim and points out a massive glaring omission. The word dismissed does not appear anywhere in the text.
Exactly. The rule provides two distinct paths. Hold a one-sided hearing where only the HOA presents evidence, or cancel the hearing entirely and kick the file back upstairs to the Department of Real Estate Directors to figure out what to do next.
The trust is building a devastating argument here. They're claiming that administrative law judges, unlike superior court judges, do not possess inherent sweeping powers to dismiss cases simply to manage their dockets or punish unruly lawyers.
Their powers are strictly limited to what is explicitly written in the administrative code. Because R2-19-117 does not grant the power of straight dismissal, the trust argues that Judge Abramson completely exceeded her legal authority.
This specific conflict highlights the tension at the heart of administrative law. Was this an illegal act born of personal frustration? Did the judge, angered by a condescending lawyer who stormed out of her room, impulsively slam the gavel and write dismissed without consulting the exact boundaries of her regulatory authority?
Or, conversely, was she a dedicated officer of the court facing an unprecedented disruption, utilizing the only practical tool available to maintain the integrity of her courtroom when a litigant flatly refused to participate?
It is a profound Rorschach test for how you view the justice system. Do you prioritize strict textual adherence to the rules, even if it rewards a lawyer acting terribly? Or do you prioritize a judge's inherent right to maintain order and dismiss a party who abandons the process?
The trust clearly sides with the strict textual interpretation, and their response to this dismissal is not to file a quiet appeal. Their response is total war.
This initiates the aftermath, a period defined by massive, multi-pronged legal retaliation. The trust does not return to the administrative agency. They bypass it entirely and file an original special action in the Maricopa County Superior Court.
Now, a special action in Arizona is a unique, highly aggressive procedural tool. It is not a standard appeal where you argue a judge made a mistake analyzing the facts.
So how is it different?
A special action is essentially a direct lawsuit against a government official or a government body. It is used when you are alleging that a state actor failed to perform a mandatory duty or, crucially in this case, that they acted completely outside their legal jurisdiction.
And the trust casts an incredibly wide net with this lawsuit. They sue Judge Kay Abramson personally in her official capacity. They sue Tammy Eigenheer, the interim director of the Office of Administrative Hearings, arguing she was complicit in treating the fiat as a motion. They sue the Arizona Department of Real Estate, the agency housing the entire process. And, ensuring all bases are covered, they name the Sunland Springs Village HOA as a defendant in the civil suit as well.
They sued the judge. It is the ultimate escalation. When a judge is sued in their official capacity, they do not hire a private defense attorney. They're state employees, so they are defended by the state.
Right, so the Arizona Attorney General's office steps in to represent Judge Abramson and Director Eigenheer. You would assume the Attorney General is going to file a massive brief defending the judge, arguing about inherent courtroom authority and the sanctity of the administrative process.
But that is not what happens. Instead, we see the first massive shocker of the aftermath, the state's surrender.
Wait, they surrender?
Basically, yeah. An assistant attorney general files a terse formal notice with the Superior Court regarding the judge and the director. The notice declares that the Attorney General's office will not be defending the action.
They will not be submitting any responsive pleadings to counter the trust's narrative. They are effectively stepping back and letting the lawsuit proceed unopposed.
And the trust reacts to this with absolute glee. They immediately file a motion for judgment on the case filings, seeking to weaponize the state's silence.
They pivot to Rule 8 of the Arizona Rules of Civil Procedure, which establishes a foundational pillar of civil litigation. An allegation is admitted if a responsive pleading is required and the allegation is not denied.
The mechanics of Rule 8 are brutal. If I sue you and allege you broke a contract and you fail to file a document explicitly denying that allegation, the court assumes my allegation is true by default.
The trust takes this principle and applies it to the state. They have listed 17 specific severe allegations in their special action complaint. They allege that Judge Abramson proceeded without or in excess of jurisdiction. They allege her dismissal was arbitrary and capricious and an abuse of discretion.
Because the Attorney General's office chose not to file a defense denying those 17 points, the trust argues that the state of Arizona has legally confessed to them.
They are demanding the court rule in their favor by default, officially declaring that the judge went rogue.
But we really have to look deeper into the mechanics of state government to understand this move. Is the Attorney General's silence an actual admission of guilt, or is it a calculated litigation strategy?
Right, because the state isn't just going to give up if they think they're right.
Exactly. The trust's own lawyer, in a moment of ironic legal citation, references a case called State versus Santana, noting that courts presume a lawyer's conduct is strategic. The Attorney General's office is a massive bureaucracy dealing with thousands of cases. From complex constitutional challenges to major criminal appeals, they possess limited resources and must triage their battles.
It is the legal equivalent of cutting your losses. The AG's office likely reviewed this file, saw the incredibly toxic 18-month history of this HOA dispute, saw the midnight filing, read the strict text of Rule R2-19-117 regarding failure to appear, and realized that defending Judge Abramson's specific use of the word dismissed would require hundreds of hours of complex appellate work.
They looked at the cost-benefit analysis and decided, we are not wasting taxpayer money defending a procedural anomaly in a neighborhood fight over digital ballots.
By refusing to defend, they are likely attempting to force the Superior Court to just vacate the dismissal and send the case back down to start over, washing their hands of the mess. It is a strategic retreat, not a moral surrender.
Exactly. The state withdraws from the battlefield. But the war between the trust's lawyer, John Sullivan, and the HOA's lawyer, Chad Gallacher, continues to escalate. And it devolves from complex arguments over statutory jurisdiction into a petty, hand-to-hand knife fight over a PDF attachment.
Oh, this is my favorite part. The altered waiver drama. This sequence of emails is arguably the most revealing part of the entire deep dive. It highlights how much of the imposing formal machinery of the law actually relies on mundane administrative agreements and basic professional courtesy.
Yeah, when you file a lawsuit like this special action, you are legally required to formally serve the defendants with the paperwork, ensuring they have notice of the suit.
Historically, this means hiring a process server to physically track the person down and hand them a stack of papers. However, to save time and money, lawyers frequently utilize a waiver of service.
One lawyer emails the other and says, I filed a lawsuit against your client. Instead of making me pay a guy to find you, will you just sign this form acknowledging you received the complaint?
It is standard operating procedure. So on October 10th, John Sullivan, representing the trust, emails Chad Gallacher, representing the HOA. He attaches the lawsuit and a pre-written waiver of service form. Sullivan has already filled out the form, dating it October 10th.
And this date is critical because the moment a waiver is effective, a procedural clock starts ticking. The HOA has exactly 60 days from the effective date to file their formal response to the lawsuit with the court.
If the effective date is October 10th, the 60-day clock means the HOA's massive legal response is due sometime in early December. Sullivan sends the email and asks Gallacher to sign and return it.
But Gallacher does not immediately sign the document. He replies a few days later, acknowledging the email, but stating he is currently out of town. He does not actually process the paperwork until a full month later on November 12th.
And this is where the professional courtesy completely breaks down. When Gallacher finally signs the document on November 12th, he doesn't just sign his name on the line.
He takes a pen, or utilizing digital editing software, and physically crosses out the October 10 date that Sullivan had pre-typed onto the form.
He manually writes in November 12th, signs it, and emails the altered PDF back to Sullivan.
By unilaterally changing that date, Gallacher executes a massive tactical shift. He effectively moves the HOA's deadline to respond from early December to January 12th of the following year.
He single-handedly grants himself an extra month of breathing room, completely bypassing the holiday season.
Now, you do not alter another attorney's drafted legal document without explicit permission. When Sullivan receives this PDF, he just explodes.
He immediately files emergency documents with the Superior Court, accusing the HOA lawyer of unauthorized alteration. Sullivan argues that because the HOA did not file their responsive answer by his original December deadline, they are officially in default.
He asks the court to strike the HOA's defenses entirely and rule in favor of the trust.
The correspondence attached to these filings is a masterpiece of passive-aggressive legal communication. Sullivan emails Gallacher, demanding compliance with a tone of icy formality. Hello, Mr. Gallacher. Please sign the waiver and acceptance and email it to me. See my email dated 101025. Thank you. Respectfully.
He is treating opposing counsel like a disobedient child failing to follow basic instructions.
But Gallacher's response is even colder, cloaked in procedural righteousness. He replies, Mr. Sullivan, please find attached the signed waiver of service form. I made a minor modification to the language of the form to reflect the date of signing as the effective date, as is both appropriate and customary. Regards.
Appropriate and customary. It is an incredible piece of legal shade.
It really is.
Gallacher's formal argument to the court is essentially a masterclass in leverage. He argues, a waiver is a voluntary act. If you choose to rely on my signature to prove to the court that I was served, you must accept the terms under which I provided that signature. I signed it on November 12th, so it is effective November 12th.
if you did not like my modification, your remedy was simple. Mm-hmm. You should have rejected my form, hired a process server, and served me the hard way.
Exactly. It is the boldest possible stance. He is telling Selvin, if you want the cheap, easy route, you play by my timeline. If you want your timeline, go pay a guy 50 bucks to knock on my door.
The level of animosity required to fight over a crossed-out date on a PDF perfectly mirrors the animosity required to demand screenshots of digital ballots in the first place. The entire case is a fractal of petty warfare.
And caught squarely in the crossfire of this escalating madness is the Arizona Department of Real Estate.
The ADRE's role in this aftermath is purely comedic desperation. They are named as a defendant in the special action, but they want absolutely nothing to do with this blood feud.
The agency's lawyers file a motion practically begging the Superior Court to either dismiss them from the lawsuit entirely or, at the very least, designate them as a nominal party.
They cite a precedent called the Bromley Group case. They explain that a nominal party is an entity that has absolutely no financial or substantive stake in the outcome of the litigation. A nominal party does not advocate for either side. They are simply an administrative vessel.
The ADRE argues, we do not care about the electronic ballots. We do not care if a screenshot is required. We do not care about the 12:13 a.m. filing. Our only job is to process the paperwork.
We are just the referee who got accidentally tackled by both teams, and we are laying on the field asking someone to just tell us who has the ball when the fighting is over.
The ADRE just wants the Superior Court to tell them if Judge Abramson is still legally assigned to the case or not, so they can update their internal filing system. The bureaucracy is entirely paralyzed by the tactical warfare of the litigants.
So as we pull back and look at this sprawling, chaotic landscape, what is the core lesson here? We have traced a journey that began with 1,400 digital votes in a suburban election.
It mutated into a philosophical debate over the metaphysical nature of a ballot.
It escalated into a hyper-calculated 12:13 a.m. legislative ambush, triggered a dramatic courtroom walkout, resulted in a judge being sued by her own citizens, forced the state attorney general into a strategic surrender, and devolves into two highly paid lawyers fighting a digital knife fight over a crossed-out date on an email attachment.
It is quite the list.
What should you, the listener, someone trying to understand the realities of our justice system, take away from this dizzying legal labyrinth?
I think the most profound takeaway is the complete demystification of the legal process. Popular culture conditions us to believe that the law is primarily concerned with grand, sweeping arguments of justice, morality, and truth, argued passionately before a jury.
But this deep dive reveals that the day-to-day reality of civil litigation is often a hyper-complex machine constructed from rigid deadlines, strict statutory definitions, and intricate procedural tripwires.
It is not a John Grisham novel. It is aggressive, militarized accounting.
Precisely. And within that machine, the victor is not necessarily the party with the most righteous moral argument, or even the party who is fundamentally correct in a cosmic sense.
The victor is frequently the party who understands the mechanics of the machine the best, the side that reads the clock and the calendar with the most precision.
The trust realized the exact minute a new legislative right granted them leverage, and they deployed it flawlessly. The HOA recognized the exact boundaries of the procedural rules regarding bloodlines, and they used them as a shield. The entire saga is an exercise in utilizing leverage within the razor-thin margins of the rulebook.
It is a terrifying testament to how complicated the law can be when two parties simply refuse to compromise.
It certainly reinforces my decision to never run for a seat on my local HOA board, that's for sure. But as we wrap up this exploration, I want to leave you, the listener, with one final unresolved puzzle.
Oh, the retroactivity question.
Yeah, it is a hanging legal question buried deep within the HOA's defensive filings, and it has the potential to act as a trap door that can drop the trust's entire midnight strategy on its head. It centers on the concept of retroactivity.
This is perhaps the most complex legal theory in the entire stack of documents.
The HOA's lawyers cite a foundational Arizona statute, ARS Section 1244. The text of the law is incredibly brief, but incredibly absolute. It states, no statute is retroactive unless expressly declared therein.
It establishes a fundamental rule of how time works in the legal universe. Laws are designed to look forward, governing future behavior.
They do not look backward to change the rules of the past unless the legislature specifically writes a clause stating this law applies retroactively.
And the logic behind this is fairness. You cannot punish someone today for an action that was perfectly legal yesterday. The rules of the game must be established before the game is played.
And this is where the timeline of our HOA dispute creates a massive paradox. The new law granting the right to a peremptory change of judge, the law the trust utilized at 12:13 a.m., officially took effect on September 26, 2025.
But the trust's case against the HOA regarding the electronic ballots began way back in early 2024.
The HOA argues that applying this brand new procedural weapon to a case that has already been actively litigated for 18 months constitutes an illegal retroactive application of the statute.
It is a phenomenal legal question. Imagine you are playing a championship basketball game. Both teams understand the rules, but right at halftime, the league commissioner announces a new rule change. Three-point shots are now worth 4 points, effective immediately.
Does that new rule apply to the second half of the game you are currently playing? Or must you finish your specific game under the rules that existed when the referee blew the opening whistle?
The HOA cites Arizona Supreme Court precedent, pointing to cases like Stewart versus Insurance Co. of North America, to argue that a litigant's substantive rights are locked in and governed strictly by the laws that were in place on the day the initial petition was filed.
So here's the thought to mull over long after this deep dive ends. Could the trust's brilliant, hyper-calculated 12:13 a.m. tactical gambit ultimately fail? Not because they missed a 15-day notice deadline, not because their lawyer was allegedly condescending and stormed out of the room, and not because of a crossed-out date on a PDF waiver.
Could it fail simply because they were trying to play a brand new powerful card in a legal game that had already been ongoing for 18 months under an older, entirely different rulebook?
It is exactly the kind of complex, muddy, structural, legal question that keeps appellate court judges awake at night. The intersection of time, procedure, and substantive rights is where the most difficult law is written.
Muddy waters indeed. We often think of the law like an x-ray of a broken arm, a clean binary image. It is either broken or it is not broken. You are either liable or you are not.
But when you step into the world of administrative law, jurisdictional battles, and deeply entrenched neighborhood disputes, that clear x-ray machine shatters completely. You are no longer looking at clean lines.
You are analyzing crossed-out dates, debating midnight timestamps, and fighting over the exact dictionary definition of a motion versus a fiat.
And perhaps the most surprising realization of all is that sometimes the murkiest, most vicious, and legally complex waters are not found in corporate boardrooms or federal courts. They are found right there, bubbling beneath the surface of your own suburban neighborhood.